the difference between the guy who gets to be the champion and the people who are the worst is the guy who's the champion just never stopped. He just never quit. He never gave up. He never was like, oh, I don't feel comfortable with this. And the same thing goes for running, podcasting. Of course, if you listen back to your first few podcasts, I'm sure you'd be like, oh my God, I was disgraceful. I was horrible. But would you say you're on 400th episode? 400 episodes, it's like anything. Reps. More reps, the better you're going to be.
Ken Rideout, you are one of the most interesting people I've studied. I've done over 400 of these episodes, and I like to do my digging on people, really understand them before I sit down with them. And I have never encountered somebody who is fighting so many demons, able to go through them, so vulnerable, so open about those struggles, and allow those demons to help him propel him to a new reality. And so because of that, I'm so grateful and honored for you to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your deep intellectual understanding of me, because that was a pretty good summation, and I one that I would agree with. I think that part of going through recovery, when you're going through that process, one of the mantras there is that you're only as sick as the secrets you keep. And at some point along this running process or kind of public-facing persona, I just came to grips with the fact that I'm an open book. And the more vulnerabilities I share, the more it's been, I think, helpful to other people in terms of dealing with their own vulnerabilities and recognizing that no one's special, no one's unique, no matter what accomplishments you have, what kind of physical feats that you're accomplishing, et cetera, there is, we're all dealing with this struggle of life, some people more so than others. I always admire people that seem so incredibly balanced and happy. And, I'm working towards getting to that place myself, but thank you for the, kind introduction and the thorough summation of who I am.
Yeah, well, I think a good place to start might be with making $35,000 a year in New York City and then punching a guy in the face. What happened next?
I tell my children, at some point, no one wants to have a fight. I'm not the toughest guy in the world. It's human nature, right? No one wants to get into a fight. But when the crowd sees that you're willing to fight, no one wants to F with that guy. And I tell the kids all the time, it stinks. I hope you don't have to do it. But when someone pushes you to a certain point, you have to knuckle them. And everyone else who sees that is going to recognize, like, oh, those Rideout kids, they might not be the toughest, but they will fight. So pick on someone else. And that's kind of always how I've carried myself. And yeah, I was in my first real, like, kind of high finance job on a trading desk. The guys were bullying me and hazing me. It was crazy. It's crazy to think back on it now that I didn't do more than just smack him. But the guy was hazing me and I gave him a slap. And they fired me. Like, this is how naive I was. I didn't even know that I was entitled to severance. They were like, you're getting 2 weeks severance. To me, I was like, I hit the lottery. I was like, oh, I got 2 weeks to figure this out. But after that was like the slap heard around the world, or at least around Wall Street, because within 2 days, I had a job making twice as much money as I was making. I think it resonated with a lot of people. And as I just described, when people know that you'll defend yourself, win or lose, they want to be affiliated with that. Everyone wants to be affiliated and associated with people that stick up for themselves and defend what they think is right. And at a certain point, I'm not with all that clowny shit. If you want to be a bully, then let's do this. You might beat me, but we're fighting. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how I lived my life always. I don't want problems, but if someone's looking for a problem, I can accommodate. I'd rather not, but I won't be bullied. Yeah. I can't. I'm too insecure. I can't sleep at night knowing someone up to a certain point. Look, some shit you have to let go. But, you know, certain level of disrespect, you owe it to yourself to be like, no, not today, dude. I ain't the one for this. I'm not, like I said, I'm not with all this clowny bullshit. I'm a serious person. I try to be live my life in a serious manner. I like to have fun, but it's also, this is serious. I have a family. I have a lot of responsibilities, and like I said, I like to have a laugh, but not at my expense to a certain extent.
What were the earliest signs for you of being a fighter and being someone who would stick up for their values?
Well, through elementary and high school, I was like a pretty well balanced kid. I mean, I had a horrible upbringing, had a horrible home situation, but it was in check. And I was like, in high school, I got along really well with the teachers. I was friends with the principal. I wouldn't say I was a teacher's pet, but I never had problems. I was the quarterback of the football team. I was like, I liked my station in life. And when I went to college is when I started to realize how unprepared I was for life. You know, you're living at home through high school, and you know, things just made sense. It was simple. You know, go to school. I didn't study really hard. I never really exerted myself academically, which is a big regret of mine. I mean, if I could go back and do it over again, I would have absolutely gone to the Naval Academy or West Point. It haunts me to this day because I'm like, I missed it. I missed my calling. It's one of the few things that I genuinely regret. But instead, I went to state school, Framingham State, paid for it myself by working at the prison as a guard in a prison. And when I got there and started to realize how on my own I was paying for everything. I was kind of like operating without a safety net. And at some point, it kind of hit me, and that's when I fell into, you know, casual drug use like booze, cocaine. And, once I tried cocaine, I was like, oh, I love this. But that kind of ran its course. After a while, you realize what a losing proposition that is. Sounds like the best idea. I always tell people the happiest time in doing cocaine is like the 10 minutes before you know you're going to get some cocaine. Then as soon as you do it, it just slowly goes downhill and it just accelerates more by the hour. And by the time it's time to go home and the sun starts to come up, you're like in a free fall or like in a whirlpool getting sucked down. But yeah, that didn't last terribly long. A few years, a casual, like a weekend thing with my friends. And then when I, but that's when I started to lose my way. That's when I really started to struggle and have, I hesitate to say mental health issues, but that was when I first started to notice like feelings of depression, anxiety, just feeling ill-prepared for the world. I had no like real parental guidance in terms of how to be an adult. And as a result of that, the first time I tried opioids, I was like, oh, I found my nirvana. I was like, I'm perfectly at ease when I'm high.
That was a little bit later, right?
Yeah, that was later, but
There were similarities to the cocaine as the opioids?
A little bit, in the sense that like that initial high was really positive and kind of gave me some freedom there to like not feel as anxious as I normally would. But really in college is when I started to, like I said, in high school, I was really happy and like balanced and I liked myself and I was comfortable in my own skin. And then in college, just shit just came apart. Not to the point of like, you know, I need to check into a mental health facility, but that's when I started to like struggle with the mental health demons. I just was like, man, in high school, I think you're always like, oh, it's all going to work itself out. I'm going to figure this out. And in college, you're like, oh shit, the clock is running. We're getting close here. In the first couple of years, I was just a shit student. Like I'm talking like a 2.0 grade point average. Like you could get a 2.0 and not even attend classes. Like you could fake your way through that. And then with a couple years to go, I realized like, oh my God, I've got to like start thinking about what I'm going to do for a job. I'm not going to be a professional athlete. This is coming to an end quickly because I was playing football and hockey in college. And when I started to apply myself, I actually got really good grades, made the dean's list the last few semesters. And I thought for a while maybe I'd be a physical therapist. then realize I didn't really want to touch anybody who was skittish about, you know, healthcare. And I realized quickly, like, I think sales might be the only gig for me. Like I said, in hindsight, I would have done a million things differently. But
what do you wish someone said to you back then?
I wish that I knew that there were options available to me that I know are available now that I wouldn't have thought at the time. For instance, if someone said to me, go to New York and work on a trading desk, work in finance, I would have said, okay, what about being an astronaut? Like, well, what are you talking? Like, people that I knew didn't go to New York to work on Wall Street. It was completely foreign. It was like being an astronaut. I was like, that's for rich guys. That's for people that have that academic pedigree and have those connections. I had none of that. I didn't know anything. I didn't know anybody, and I didn't know anything about it. And when I finally did move to New York and was working in a pharmaceutical sales job, I was playing in a men's hockey league and met a guy who happened to work on a trading desk who went to St. Lawrence, a Canadian kid who unfortunately died in 9/11. We both worked at Cantor Fitzgerald on the top floor of the World Trade Center. And when we were playing hockey, he's like, hey, we need a trading assistant. You should come and talk to them. And literally, I went, talked to them. And this is the funny thing about that kind of finance is, like, that's how quickly it went. I was like, okay, you're hired. Start tomorrow. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, they go through that kind of analyst program where they rotate through several desks. And that's the more traditional sense, super competitive. You know, it's, like, really competitive to get those jobs. But I kind of slipped in through the back door by working as a broker dealer, which we were basically brokering trades between the big trading desks. So it was like institutional sales and trading. And yeah, to me, that was just like, all right, I got my foot in the door. I got a seat at the table. And once you're in, once you're at the table, then it's all based on merit. So all you really need is just someone to give you a chance. And back then, it was just like the needle in the haystack opportunity where it's like everything lined up and I got the job, but I was also being tormented on a daily basis for the first like month or two. It was awful.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because when I studied your story, it seems like you've done this time and time again. You've got into the back door and approached the industry in a way that other people haven't. Mm. In podcasting, you're working with Teddy Atlas and you're on the podcast circuit in ultras, and it's like you – everything you do seems to be, and even the job you had where you moved to LA, it's like, it's all backdoor stuff. What do you know about getting in the back door that most people don't?
I can hear all the inappropriate jokes about the back door. I would say this, man, I have a survivor's mentality, but the biggest thing that I've done that's led to my success is I've always been willing to eat what I kill, meaning when I went to LA, so I was working in sales and trading. We can circle back. I'm sorry to jump around. I moved to LA. I've been working in sales and trading for 20 years. Moved to LA with a financial technology firm that a friend of mine, Amar Kuchinad, started. He used to run structured trading at Goldman. I've always had the best, most eclectic group of friends. It's something that I pride myself on. My friends know this. Like, you call me and tell me someone's coming to your house to fight you, some guys are going to be like, I'll call the cops for you. I'm coming. I'm going to help you. I'm not running away. And because I know they would do that too. And the one thing that I've done really well that I feel super proud of, and I don't have a lot of things that I feel like this about, is my friends. I have the best group of friends. I absolutely love them. And it's the most eclectic crew ever. And so I was working with Amar. I knew it probably wouldn't work, but I had to get off the effing trading desk. It was just hell on earth. It was sounds sexy and it was cool. You could make some money, but I like to say that it was a good job, not necessarily a career for me. I couldn't see longevity there. And I moved to LA with my four kids. We were renting a house for $12,000 a month in the Palisades. Like it was just, I basically put myself in a position where I have to figure this out, and I was running out of dough. So, you know, was at a startup. I think I probably was making 200 grand, which, you know, for some people it may sound like a lot, but not when your rent is $12,000 a month and you got four children. So I've always, you know, for the last like 10 years been involved in endurance sports. I did the Ironman in Hawaii 3 times, so I was really into riding my bike and running. And I was riding my bike with a guy who's now here in Austin, called Jack McDowell, who was probably like the most influential person in my life ever. We were just riding our bikes together, two buddies. We had a mutual friend. We lived in the same neighborhood, and he had an asset management firm called the Palisades Group. And I basically, over the course of several months, convinced him to let me come in and do some business development for him, essentially try to raise institutional capital that he could manage. So he had about $2 billion in separately managed accounts, which sounds like a lot of money, but when you're managing for real small fees for big institutions, so like XYZ hedge fund might have a fund that has some exposure to residential credit, residential mortgage credit, and he would manage that pool of whole loan mortgages. Because, you know, with mortgages, I'm sorry if this gets a little deep for people, but with mortgages, you either have a securitization, like a residential mortgage-backed security, RMBS, or you have whole loan residential mortgages where you're managing line items of every single loan. It's a much more involved process. You have to have servicers. It's involved. But Jack was the guru of this. But I was looking at it, I was like, this is such like an untapped resource. There's so much potential here. Like, you should raise a discretionary fund. We should raise more separately managed accounts. And long story short, he was like, yo, we're friends. I don't think you're going to be able to do this, and I don't want to have to fire you. And I was like, cool, I'll do it for free. I'll do it for free for, let's say, 3 months. And after a few weeks, it was, and he was like, yeah, okay, cool. After a few weeks, it was obvious that it was a fit. I think we grew the SMA business, the separately managed account business, to $5 billion. But more importantly, I was able to raise his first two discretionary funds. And a discretionary fund is like a private equity fund or a venture fund or hedge fund, but all from institutions. It wouldn't be like, hey, Joe Blow, can you give us $1 million? It was like $25 million here, $10 million there. And getting people to commit that kind of capital, institutions, so like insurance companies, foundations, endowments, they have professionals that are responsible for allocating that money, and trying to convince them to allocate to a first-time manager. When we talk to some placement agents, which is what I do now, independent placement agents, about helping us raise these funds, they practically laughed us out of the room. And we're like, why do you think you can do this? You guys have never managed discretionary capital. And I said, why do you think you can't? I think I can win the New York Marathon until someone beats me. Like, what a defeatist attitude. And needless to say, they passed. But I did it. We raised the money. It was...
You went from $2 billion to $5 billion, right?
In the SMA business, but we also raised some small discretionary funds. The first one was like $35 million, which is crazy because that $35 million fund, the fees associated, we managed that money with zero management fee, but 30% of the carry. So we would keep 30% of the profits. And we doubled the money, $35 million in like 26 months. So we made like $10 million.
Wow.
And it made more money than those SMA accounts, than the separately managed accounts, because the fees were so skinny on those big institutional SMAs. And then we raised the second one. And then at some point, Jack looked at me and was like, yes, you have so much more potential. You should do this as a freelance placement agent. And we worked out a deal. He paid me as a consultant for a while I segued into that. And yeah, it was crazy. The first mandate that I worked on was for a guy called David Sinclair, who wrote the book Lifespan. We raised some money for his pharma startup in Boston called Life Bioscience. And from there, it was off to the races. As soon as I had an ounce of success, and especially in that sector of like kind of health and wellness, longevity, I was inundated with opportunities. So, but then it became an exercise in like picking the ones that I thought I could be successful with, because not all of them are going to be successful.
Mm. You know, what was... I'm curious to break down like what allowed you the ability to connect with these people. How did you connect with them so well? And when we were setting this up, I couldn't help but notice how quickly you respond to things, how you updated on every little thing that was going on. Mm. My flight's at this time and I'm going to be doing this Uber at this time. And I was like, I have 400 guests on this podcast. Mm. And it's rare for somebody to be so particular and communicative about every little detail. And I was like, that's it. That's part of the reason for success. And my dad has the same thing. My dad was, he's so on top of every communication point. Mm. No stone left unturned. Mm. And it's like, that has to be part of the success, right?
I guess. I wish I could formulate everything into, I'm in the process of formulating it all, and I'm writing a book, and this process has been eye-opening to say the least. But I'm glad you noticed that, because that's how I want to be treated. I mean, you were like, hey, we got the studio at this time. So I wanted to be, yo, my flight lands at 2. If I can be there at 2:30, I think I can, but just be aware, this is what's going on. Because otherwise I would have said, I'm not interested. I don't want to do the interview. But if I'm going to do it, I'm not going to disrespect anyone. Like, either I'm not doing it, or if I am doing it, then we're in this together. I know this is your business. You think I'm going to show up here and treat your business with total disrespect? Like, how shitty would that be? Like, I actually feel pressure when I was driving here. I'm like, man, I got to give this guy a good show. He's like, you know, this is his livelihood. I feel an obligation to perform or to give you what you want. And because otherwise I would have said no. But once I say I'm going to do it, you know, I feel an obligation to show up the way I show up. I if I'm going to do something, I want to do it. I want to win.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's just against myself.
Yeah. Well, there's a part of you that is like, I don't want to hurt anyone. And then there's a part of you that's like, if we're competing, yeah, I want to fucking take everything from you. And yeah, that's the part that I'm like, I'm with you on that. Like,
I'll help you up after I beat you, but I definitely don't want to lose.
Yeah. So where does the part of you that you're like, I'm going to dominate at all costs, where does that come out, and how do you flip that switch when it's time to do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I was thinking just about when you were talking, I was just thinking about the expression, like, hurt people, hurt others. Mm. And I think that I'm so super aware of that I've, like, dealing with a lot of, like, my own personal trauma, and not to sound dramatic. I mean, it is what it is. Like, for a long time, I was like, I don't have any fucking trauma. I'm, like, rock solid. But actually, people with trauma tend to use these physical challenges is a way to demonstrate to the world subliminally, like, you can't hurt me, I'm hard as iron. I mean, even David Goggins' book's called You Can't Hurt Me. I mean, it's so like textbook, like,
I'm hurt
trauma behavior, right? Yeah. And I mean, he talks about that openly in his book, so I don't think it's a big secret. But I think that I've disappointed myself to such an extent through my addiction that now when I have opportunities to kind of prove myself, and like I said, I don't profess to have all the answers, and I don't know that this is like that I'm doing things like emotionally healthiest way possible, but this is like my survival technique, for lack of a better term. And when I feel challenged, even if it's a challenge I give to myself, like the race I did in the Gobi Desert in Mongolia, like, I'm demonstrating to myself that I can do this. Like, no amount of physical pain can stop me. There's a difference between pain and injury, right? If you're injured, you're injured. You can't go on. But if it's just pain and discomfort, this kind of pain and discomfort I'm dealing with pales in comparison to the emotional pain that I've dealt with as a result of the addiction journey. I mean, and the only way I can describe that in summary is to say, like, imagine if every day you thought about killing yourself. Like, fucking, I can't go on like this. Like, if I can't get out of this, I'm ending this. I'm not going to keep doing this. And I believed it. I was like, man, we have to fix this. Cause it was literally like the two voices in my head of one, like, we can do this. Let's get out of this. Let's pull ourselves out of this. And then the other voice, like, we're never getting out of this. It's a 10-year cycle. It's only getting worse. Like, this ends in tears. And eventually that, you know, kind of beta voice became the alpha to say, nah, fuck this. Don't go out like this. Don't embarrass yourself. And then there was no like home crowd. It was like, until I met my wife, there was no like support crew behind me telling me, like, keep fighting. It was just me, myself, and I. Mm. And that's the best way I can describe it, is like, when you've been through that kind of pain, these physical challenges, getting up and run every day, it's like almost laughable compared to what I did go through.
Yeah. Well, I was listening to My First Million and your appearance on My First Million. It's actually how I got introduced to you. And
I love those guys, by the way. Incredible. Sam is a great dude.
Incredible. And What was so fascinating to me was they asked you, who's the most emotionally tough person you know?
Yeah.
And you start to tear up a little bit, or eyes, of your course. Eyes start to well because you said your wife.
Oh, dude, I'm a big pussy. I cry all the time. I can't control it. But at the same time, I'm like, hey, I'm an emotional person. What am I going to do? But my wife is the toughest, man. My wife, when I went to a trauma healing center called Onsite. It was like a 4-day mental health retreat, for lack of a better term. And you, it's just one-on-one therapy for like, you know, 5 or 6 hours a day, some group classes. Even going to that place, I mean, driving there, I was feeling like I was driving to like the electric chair. I was like, what the fuck am I doing? Why am I doing this? You know, we get there. I didn't do any research. I didn't know anything. I just knew I needed help. This was last January. And I, you know, you get there and they take my phone. And right away, I'm like, oh, I didn't put a notification on my phone. I'm like, all these scenarios. But it's just textbook. It's like, no one's looking for you, man. When I got out of there, it was not like the world didn't explode. No one was like, nothing was pressing. And, you know, so that it was called a trauma healing center. And when I got there, I didn't think I had trauma. But by the end of it, I'm like, holy shit, I've been traumatized. And it was really good. But one of the things, one of the realizations that I had while there is, you know, I was talking to the therapist and I'm like, man, I just can't get along with my wife and blah, blah, blah. And I'm explaining to her all the things that we, all the challenges. And then she said, you know, this woman was like a Svengali. I mean, she was so intelligent, like so plugged in. She understood me immediately. Like I was blown away. And she was like, you know, I think you've given your wife every chance you can to leave you and to like blow this whole thing up. And I'm like, yeah, that's right. I've almost dared her at times. And she was like, but she's so strong that she's like, fuck this guy. He's an idiot. He's going to eventually figure this out. And for the sake of my children and her and our family, and even for me, she held it together when I wasn't tough enough to. And when you realize that, it was, this is why I get emotional about it, because I was just, you know, I let the trauma kind of lead the way in my relationship, and my ego would constantly get in the way of our relationship. And it still does. This is not you just go somewhere, fucking snap your fingers and you're Gucci. No, this is like a daily struggle where I have to remind myself of this all the time, of like, don't let your ego destroy the only thing that matters. The only thing that matters to me is my family, and nothing else matters. Like, honestly, without that, I don't know how long I would be able to maintain my life without my wife and kids. I wouldn't, in a million years, I would never not live with my children. It's like my calling in life. But I still struggle with my behavior and trying to get along with my wife and giving her what she wants and managing my own expectations. It's a marriages, man. I tell people all the time, when you are dating someone, you're hanging out with your friend. It's like, hey, no kids, no real responsibilities other than your jobs. So on the weekends, you can sleep in, you can, on a drop of a dime, go to the Bahamas. You can do whatever you want. When you have children, all of a sudden now with that same person who is your best friend, now you're running like a deadly serious business together, and someone's got to get up with the kids. Someone's got to feed them. For 5 years, they can't eat or take a shit without you being there to wipe their ass, physically feed them. Like, it's, I know it sounds crazy to people who have kids. Like, they're probably saying like, yeah, no shit. But these things, when they're happening to you, you're like, oh my God, I wanted kids desperately. That's why the best decision I ever made was marrying my wife, because I knew she would be the partner that I wanted with regards to raising a family. And yeah, it's just at times it gets overwhelming and the responsibilities just pile up. But I knew that my wife wanted to be a mom more than anything. So I've been very lucky in the fact that when someone had to wake up with the kids, she didn't work while we had, well, when we started the family, she wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, wife. So she did take the, like, I would say the lion's share, but like, I don't know if that's an accurate depiction of someone who does 100% of the work, but she was awesome at it. She was so good at being a mom. I always tell her whenever I have conflicts with the kids, I'm like, oh, this is so hard. It's like, you're the friggin' Lance Armstrong of parenting. And I'm like the big fatso who just bought a Peloton trying to keep up with you. The kids are looking at me like I'm crazy because my wife is like, awesome at it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't come naturally to me.
Yeah. Well, at the same time, I was listening to you on previous podcasts. You do like make great effort in, even though you're not, you don't consider yourself a natural parent. Like you take your kids to jujitsu and have them do sports and stuff like that. And so I think that, you know, you got to give yourself credit too. Maybe you don't have the emotional pieces locked down.
Yeah, that's accurate.
But you do have the desire to improve.
Yes.
And you do have the thought and the love for them. And and my dad is an incredible mentor and he's an incredible person. The emotional piece sometimes isn't there, but I know he showed up for my Little League games.
Yeah.
I know that he loves me. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I have the hardness from him and I can do what I need to do. But my mom is like the best mom ever. So that gives you a sense for like what your kids might be going up and growing through, because I dealt with that and it's all good. Like, and you're doing your best. So on the parenting piece, what have you learned about parenting that surprised you?
Aside from it being incredibly hard. I mean, I have a 13-year-old daughter. Oh my God, it's been by far the most challenging aspect of parenting, right? When she was a baby, we were like besties. Like she would be, like couldn't get close enough to me. We would snuggle and super affectionate. I'd kiss her all the time. Now she's 13, has braces, like would never kiss me. I mean, I hold her down and force her to give me a kiss goodnight. But she's like, Dad, I'm too old for this. And I was like, you know, you're never going to be too old. When you get married, I'm still going to be kissing you in front of your own children. But I'm just super affectionate. That's the one thing I've done with my children that was never done with me, is I tell them that I loved them like multiple times a day, almost to the point of they're like, Dad, enough with the bullshit. And I'm like, nah, I just got to make sure you know, because even if I don't behave accordingly and I get mad and snap at them, I still want them to know how much I love them. And I try to have like heart-to-heart conversations with them. But that doesn't make up for, you know, deficiencies in terms of patience. That's been my biggest challenge, is patience. You know, like, one of the hardest parts of parenting young children is they don't know until they know. Their brain isn't developed. So, like, for example, they'll go in and pour some orange juice and then leave the container on the counter. And I come in, I go, and my wife's like, they don't think like you. Because I come in, I'm like, who did this? Why would you leave it there? Because now someone else has to do it. So if I have orange juice, I got to put mine away plus yours. If everyone does that, I have to put everyone's away. Or the dishes. Why didn't you put the dish in the dishwasher? Now I have to, now there's a whole sink full of them, so I have to do it. But if we all do our own, that's common sense. But to a kid, they're like, dude, relax.
I think I have PTSD from my dad. I'm like literally hearing him when you say this. It's remarkable, yeah.
But I didn't have a dishwasher when I was a kid. We washed them in the sink, so I would never think to wash my dishes as a kid. Someone else would do it, like my mom or my grandmother who lived with us. But that kind of stuff has been – I beat myself up for it after the fact, because I'm like, damn it. I let my emotions get the better of me. I got to just take a deep breath and calm down. And one of the things that I did when I came back from on-site is I was recording my podcast on the Monday I came back, and it's right above. We have like a downstairs area, and they have like a theater down there that they treat like a jungle gym. So they're down there playing the Amazon Alexa super loud. Now, normally I'd be like, guys, hold on one second. I'd fly down there. I'd be like, guys, what the hell? You know I'm recording. Why are you doing this? You guys are really pissing me off. And this time I just went down and go, hey, guys, I'm recording the podcast. I love you. I know you're having fun, but maybe chill a little bit with the volume. They're like, oh, Dad, sorry. We'll go outside. And I was like, what the heck? Did I just learn a magic trick? But it was like such common sense. But those, sometimes you need that reminder and a kick in the ass. And then the horrible part is after I do that and they're like, oh, sorry, we'll go outside. Like, I can't help but to start crying. Cause yeah. I'm like, how much fucking time have I wasted yelling at them instead of just like taking a minute to explain things calmly to them? Mm-hmm. Not to say that I don't always yell, but when I do, I get down on myself, but I get more down on myself when they give me back total love as a reward for treating them kindly.
Yeah, because it pulls up all the time that you could have done that.
Exactly.
And the key thing to realize is the past is the past, and accepting it as it was is like the the trick to life, and it's hard to do, and it's easy to say, but when you accept what is, it leaves you feeling peace. Why'd you go to that on-site? Yeah, what was that about? What spurred that?
I just wasn't getting along with my wife, and it wasn't – she's pretty consistently the same person, and I was I wasn't happy. And I was like, I'm definitely not going to get a divorce, but I can't keep going like this because one of us is going to kill the other one. And I don't know. A friend of mine had gone there. It wasn't cheap. And I was just like, I can't believe I'm going to spend this kind of bread and do this, but I'm doing it. I want to be better. I want to be happy. I want peace. And it ended up being one of the best decisions I ever made. And then mentioned it to a bunch of friends that went there after the fact. And a friend of mine had recommended it, a guy who played for the Tennessee Titans. And he was, I was on the fence and I was like, yo, on site, yes or no? He's like, do it. Best thing I ever did. I'm like, I'll call you back. And I just called up and signed up.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's remarkable because you have faced so much physical suffering of your own choosing, at least in the past 20 years. But the emotional suffering is maybe the reason why the physical suffering is taking place and why you're going to these extremes, because you say to yourself, well, I know that pain and yeah. I'll enjoy that pain. But the emotional stuff, I don't want to have to think about what I'll happened do anything in my childhood.
I'll be anything to not be alone with myself.
But it's interesting because when you do these races, you have a lot of time alone with yourself, no?
Yeah. But that's when I harness the pain and the emotions and the struggles that I've gone through and put it into context and recognize like, this ain't shit compared to real pain. Mm. Real pain, you can't get away from. Physical pain, it's a rounding error. It's like, oh, this sucks, but I know that this is going to end. And if I empty the tank and push through this and go real hard, not only will the pain end, but I'll get to celebrate being recognized as like good at something. Mm-hmm. And that insecurity inside of me forces me to have to be good at something. That's a whole nother struggle. Like, why am I doing this? Is this counterproductive to who I am and who I want to be? I don't know. That could be part of the problem. But for now, it's keeping me alive. It's keeping me motivated. It's provided the children an example of what's possible. I was telling someone this the other day. It's like one of the things that I'm proud of is like my children have met some of the most iconic athletes and people. And even when I'm introducing them and when we're doing these incredible things, I'm like, holy shit, I can't believe my kids are getting to see this. Like Dana White invited me to bring my youngest son to the UFC in Boston. Wow. And we sat ringside, front row of the VIP section, right behind Rogan and the broadcast crew. And in between the main and the co-main event, Dana came over and grabbed my phone, say, hey, Cameron, come with me. He just turned 8, and he had his Celtics jersey on and his leprechaun hat. And he brought him all around the octagon right before the main event, brought him into the octagon, took a picture of him. So he's in there with his Air Jordan shoes on. And he said to we sent Dana a video the next 2 days later on Cameron in his jiu-jitsu gi. And he said, hey, Dana, thanks for the ticks. Next time you see me in the octagon, I won't have shoes on. Meaning he's going to be in there fighting, right? But that kind of stuff has been incredible. I was watching the football game with my oldest son the other night, and I got a text. And, you know, they're always, like, nosy. And he's like, Dad, who was that? And I said, oh, that's my friend Jelly Roll. He just said, hey, can you connect me with Dustin Poirier? So I was like, I just put it, normally I wouldn't do this to someone like with that, someone famous like that. Like, hey, I'm connecting you with so-and-so. I'd say, hey, Dustin, you mind if I connect you with this guy? But for that one, I was like, Dustin Poirier connected with Jelly Roll. And they were both like, oh, thanks, man, appreciate you. And then they took their conversation offline. But when stuff like that happens to me, I can hear people, I can just see and hear people listening to the interview like, oh, fuck this guy. He's super arrogant, name dropping. I'm trying to provide context to how incredible I think it is. I'm like, holy shit, this is my life. I created this. And that's something that I'm actually proud of. Like I said earlier, like the people that are in my life that are my friends, like I'm so appreciative of them. I think that you are literally a collection of the people you spend time with, and these are my friends, and it's never lost on me. I'm always like, damn, I have some cool friends. But I would hope that they would say the same thing about me.
100%. How do you go ahead and teach that same mentality to your child or children when they don't have the same suffering that you did?
That's a good question. Well, I just tell them that, like, you can, that they can see all the things and all the blessings I've received and what's come with winning. And I explain to them all the time, like, yo, people want to hang out with people that win.
Yes.
If you're just going to be mediocre at shit, no one cares about that. That's easy. And not that people are friends with me because I can win stuff. I think it's, you know, you get the introduction, however you get the introduction, but then how you behave and how you conduct yourself translates into everything. It carries over into the relationships, and I treat my friends the same way I treat my, like, physical endeavors. It's, like, serious to me. I'm like, you know what I mean? The people that are important to me. And, so for the children, I mean, they would probably laugh if they hear this. They'd be like, oh, Jesus, don't get them going. I have lessons for them every day. Every single day. I'm like, get in there, especially with jiu-jitsu, because we go every single day. So I talk to my youngest son when we're on the way, and I'm like, just get in there and empty the tank, man. When you're done, everything that you learned and did in that practice will be yours to keep forever. But if you go in there and have a shitty attitude and you don't give your best, you're going to have that forever too. And that feeling stinks. It lasts forever. Quitting and giving up never goes away. And you can never forget that you gave up on yourself, because I've done that. And that was, like, one of the biggest turning points in my life, was quitting at the Ironman the first time that I qualified for the race in Hawaii. And that sting of quitting, oh, even thinking about it now makes me want to cry. I would rather die than feel like that again. I will never quit. Not by left to my own devices. An injury, okay, you're going to get injuries. I crashed my bike once in Iceland at an Iceland half Ironman, and I was, like, close to winning, and I crashed, and I was just fucking hobbling the whole day, covered in blood, and eventually I was like, I can't go on. I'm too hurt. And that's, I can live with that, because I know I was hurt. I would keep going. But so I tried to give them examples of, like, things that I've done wrong and how they can avoid feeling certain feelings.
What advice do you have for people who are thinking about quitting or in that position of quitting? Let's call it a race.
Quitters never win and winners never quit. It's like the family mantra.
I love that.
I go, guess what quitters never do? Win. The kids are like, Dad, we know. I go, well, I just got to remind you, always be at the top of mind. Winners never quit and quitters never get to win. I also tell them, and this I think is a good lesson for everyone, whether it's running, jiu-jitsu, any physical endeavor, academic, piano lessons, anything that you're doing is like, if you're not willing to be the worst when you start, you never get to be the best. I tell my son, the jiu-jitsu guy, I'm like, imagine, because he's just started wrestling too. And when we were going to wrestling, I'm like, you're going to be the worst. Because those kids have experience. They know. But I said, imagine if a kid showed up with no experience in jiu-jitsu and he just got to ragdoll you. And he's pretty advanced for 8 years old. I mean, he's like on his third belt. And they don't just give out belts like
candy.
Yeah, you have to earn them. And I'm like, imagine if someone just came in and threw you around with no experience. You'd feel like, what the F? This has been a giant waste of time. The whole premise of this is that with experience, you get to the point where you can do anything to anyone and they can't do anything to you. And so they absorb that and listen. But that's what I tell them with everything. My daughter just started playing lacrosse and she's not the most athletic person in the world. And I'm like, listen, everyone, when Mike Tyson started boxing at one point, he was the worst in the gym. The difference between the guy who gets to be the champion and the people who are the worst is the guy who's the champion just never stopped. He just never quit. He never gave up. He never was like, oh, I don't feel comfortable with this. And the same thing goes for running, podcasting. Of course, if you listen back to your first few podcasts, I'm sure you'd be like, oh my God, I was disgraceful. I was horrible. But would you say you're on 400th episode? 400 episodes, it's like anything. Reps. More reps, the better you're going to be. And the only difference between the people that are the top and the people that stink are the people that are the top just never stopped learning and getting better.
Yes, absolutely. And on your advice for your children to continue that, one thing you said is you don't have to be good. All that we ask for is effort.
That's it.
You don't have to do sports, but you have to do something. And you have to have some passion. And we'll keep trying things until you find something you're passionate about. just going through life and not having interests is not cool.
Not acceptable.
And if you think about it, that is so true. And it's like, I wasted so much damn time just not being interested in anything, not giving effort because I just thought it was cool to not care. And I thought I should just show up and be good at things. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I just had no idea. And I wish I can get that to people's minds and hearts is like, you play pickup basketball? Go hard. Why are you playing the game if you don't expect to win? And I'm thinking about you last night when I'm playing basketball and I'm like, this dude isn't boxing out. He doesn't care. I'm like, get the hell off the court. Like, what are you doing? We're here to win.
Yeah.
So like, stop like just thinking that this is just pickup basketball. No, this is serious.
Yeah.
And so taking things seriously to me is one of the key lessons I've gotten from you.
Yeah. You summed it up perfectly. I said, you gotta be passionate about something. I don't understand or relate to people that don't have interests. When I was, running a trading desk in London and I'd interview, I mean, at one point I hired like 20 people in a few months. And when I was interviewing people, I'd be like, yo, what kind of things are you into? I don't care about traditional interview questions. I want to know like what the person's like. And I'm like, what are you into? And they're like, I don't really know. I'm like, you must have some interest. Like, do you like skiing? Fucking playing cards? I don't know. I'm like, brother, if you don't have any interest, I don't know what else to talk to you about. Like, this work is just a small part of life. Like, we're going to spend 8 hours a day together. We're going to spend more time than anyone else in your life together. I need to know that you have some interest, that something excites you. I don't give a fuck if it's Dungeons and Dragons. Be into something. Be good at something. Take pride and take ownership in something in your life outside of your career. And listen, even with career, I have respect for people that are like, all I care about is being successful in this business and building this business. That's cool. I'm with that. If that's really what you want to do, it's evident. Because people that care deeply about anything, you can tell right away. You're like, oh, this is a master at this skill.
Yeah. And when you live in the world of not having interest, it's what it really is. It's not having respect for life. It's not having respect for the gift you've been giving with your consciousness.
Yeah.
And I really admire the way in which it seems like there have been periods of your life when you're just like, I don't know what to do. I'm doing drugs and all, like, and I'm down in the dumps. And then there are periods of your life where you're like, no, like, you can actually make the most out of this thing. Mm. And it's easy for someone who was born with, they started playing hockey and they all of a sudden become the greatest hockey player in the world. They lived in that. But you've had periods where you didn't have the passion for life or the the gratefulness for it. And you had periods when you have had that same gratefulness. And so that to me is the remarkable thing. And that to me is so exciting because it means if somebody's listening to this right now and they don't have that passion for life, they don't have that gratefulness, you can get it.
Yeah. You got to just try different things and figure out what it is that you care about, what excites you. And to be clear, like when I got out of college, like for a long time, all I cared about was sports. Then I started working, making money, and kind of didn't have any passions. And when I didn't have any passions or motivations, that's when I fell into the drug use. But I always worked out hard, real hard. Like I boxed for a long time in New York. And so I was always like in decent shape. And then when I got sober, I just started in on the endurance sports, and that kind of became a distraction from the addiction and certainly from the withdrawals in the recovery process. Relied heavily upon having that outlet. It was a way for me to like be busy for a couple hours a day at a minimum. And it gave me like I just responded to the physical exertion and the physical pain that came with exercising, luckily for me. But I can see how people would be like, oh, that's too much. It sucks. It's uncomfortable. 100% it is. But the alternative to me was emotional discomfort. And the stars just aligned that I found something that resonated with me. And I had a little bit of acumen for it. You know, when people are like, oh, you're lucky, you're a good runner. I'm like, I sucked at running when I started. That's crazy. You don't make that assumption. Like, I'm not a naturally gifted athlete. I'm not naturally good at anything. I've just worked super hard. I mean, I've done this for so many years of running a minimum of 10 miles a day. To your point, without that distraction and without that interest, I'm lost at sea. Too much time on my hand. You know, like idle mind is the devil's workshop. That's never more more appropriate for anyone than for me.
What about meditation?
I have done periods of meditation, but I'd say it's more closely like aligned to like non-sleep deep rest. I try to do this, and when I do so much better. And then, you know, it's like the chubby guy who doesn't do his workouts. It's like the minute I have any excuse not to do the meditation or not to do the like NSDR, it's the first thing to get abandoned. And but yeah, I mean, for a long time, I thought of it as meditation until like my friend Andrew Huberman would talk about non-sleep deep rest. I'm like, oh shit, there's an alternative to identifying it just as meditation. And basically, I just lay there with a timer on for like 10 or 20 minutes, whatever I had, and I just try not to think of anything. I've taken some transcendental meditation courses, and so I'm familiar with the practice, but I guess it's like one of those things where I just gave up on it. I should have worked harder on it, but I think that meditation is critically important. It's just something that I know to be good for me, but I am not doing well.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And the reason why I bring it up is because it seems like the emotional piece of your life is going to be the next hill or the next mountain that if you were to devote yourself to, it could have massive returns. And you saw with your, when you came back from the retreat and then you handle your children differently. Mm-hmm. It's like, what if you live in that state? Yeah. And that's all. And there was not even a question. And that's what meditation's done for me. It's, I had an anger and I'm just like, it's all good. Now everything's good. And that took time.
Yeah.
And so I think that to be the best person you can be, you have to dominate physically, mm-hmm. but you have to dominate emotionally and spiritually yeah. as well. And what do you think you can do to take those steps to get to the next level emotionally and spiritually?
Yeah, I think it's basically about accountability, right? Mm. I've got to be accountable to myself and just make a commitment to do it. Like some of the things that I have tried to do is like limit the time I spend on my phone, whether it's looking at social media or mindlessly playing solitaire or something. Like every time I look at my phone, I have this ping of guilt. Like, oh, this is like, even for a split second time, I'm not in the, like, living my life. I'm like worrying about, not worrying, but investing time into things that don't really matter. Mm. You know, it's like, I don't know. I go back and forth with social media. It's been a good tool for me to kind of get my message out there. But at the same time, all those platforms, Instagram in particular, is like a highlight reel. No one's posting their bloopers, right? You're just posting the things that you're proud of, and it becomes a little bit disingenuous. So that's something that I've been thinking a lot about. And to be honest with you, I'd probably take a break from it. But given that, like I said, I'm writing a book, and, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, like we all have to make money, and having a bigger platform leads to more money and book sales, etc. So it's like something that I've reluctantly maintained, but it doesn't bring me like great joy. I never feel like, oh my God, my Instagram is so cool. If anything, I'm like, oh, I feel like such a narcissist posting this, but I guess this is what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah. Well, we're happiest when what we're doing in the short term aligns with what we want in the long term.
Of course.
And that's why you enjoy it so much while running, because you know this leads to long-term goals that you're trying to hit.
Yep.
And sometimes you look at social media and you don't know if the short-term actions of posting is actually leading to long-term success. Yep. But I'm curious for you, what is your current dream?
I guess in a perfect world, if I could get this book written, have it do really well, be a bestseller, and allow me to have a platform to do more speaking gigs. I've done a handful recently. I've got some more coming up. I really do enjoy that. I enjoy sharing my story. I enjoy trying to motivate and inspire people. But more so than that is the time that it then frees up for me to spend with the children and like really doing the best that I can to give them the life, that the support that I want them to have. And a lot of times people think giving their kids the life that they want equates to giving them stuff. Like I feel like the opposite. at times I'm like, we have way too much stuff. I'm going to throw some of this stuff away. And I try to emphasize to the kids, it's not about what you have. It's like about what you do, how you feel. Those are the things that matter. Like the experiences in my life are so worth so much more than anything that I have owned, could own. You know, it's that's what life is about. Like if, you know, you never hear people on their deathbed talk about, damn, dude, I'm going to miss my big screen TV. They think about what they've done, where they've been, the experiences that they've had. So that's what I'm trying to provide for the kids. And I think, you know, in a perfect world of having more money would allow me to do more things like not necessarily fancy vacations, but more diverse vacations of taking them to, like, you know, live in Italy for a month in the summer, or taking them to South Africa on safari, those kind of, you know, bigger experiences that, fortunately or unfortunately, are super expensive. And having taken a family of six, you know, on that kind of vacation is expensive. So that's the kind of, that's what I would hope, is that I can continue to have some success in sharing my story, and then continue to work towards being a good dad. Because at the end of the day, the journey is almost over. I mean, my youngest is in the second grade. That means I have 10 years left before everyone's out of my house, and my oldest is in seventh grade, so I've only got 5 years left with her, which is crazy because it just seems like she was just born. So that kind of stuff, when you put it into that context, I was telling someone the other day, it's like, man, the clock is running. There's no injury timeout. There's no TV timeout. It's running. And that's, mentality causes me crazy anxiety, because I'm like, oh shit, clock's running. What am I doing? I got to get everything done yesterday.
Yeah. But the present moment is perfect the way it is.
Exactly.
As well. And you are doing that by giving experiences to your kids, like going to the UFC, Dana White in the octagon. I'm sure your son will never forget that. And that's such a cool thing that your platform has already allowed you to do. And I'm sure will continue to do. I've done a lot of these podcasts, and it's rare for me to get so inspired and motivated while listening to the guest on a previous show. So thank you for being you. Thank you for spreading your message. Pleasure. And I have no doubt that the book that you write is going to be a tremendous success.
Thank you, brother.
I like to end these podcasts with a challenge. Okay. A challenge points to the place in your heart you believe the audience should take this conversation and actually do something with their life. Does a challenge come to mind?
I mean, a million challenges come to mind, but I would say one of the things that I've prided myself on and that I think has set me apart from a lot of other people is my ability to be consistent. So in terms of a challenge, I love when people send me a message like, hey, out of the clear blue, they'll be like, hey, just FYI, I've run every single day for like the last 2 or 3 months. And I'm like, damn, don't get hurt, dude. Because I know that that's not sustainable for a lot of people. I've been lucky in for the fact that I haven't really had big injuries, not with regards to overuse. I've had injuries. But I would say, I always emphasize, like, it's not just about running. Like, why don't you just commit to moving for an hour a day first thing in the morning? And if you don't feel like running, then walk. Eventually, if you walk, run every single day for a month, by the end of that month, it will be not even a small challenge for you to run a mile. So if you have no experience, run for a bit, walk for a bit, run. Eventually, that feeling of like, I'm going to faint will go away. Like my oldest son just started running. So he runs like 2 or 3 miles every day when he comes home from school. And when I ran with him last night, he's like, oh, I'm starting to get a cramp here. And I forgot what it feels like to get a cramp from not running. And I'm like, oh, damn. I was like, all right, just take like nice, long, deep breath. Stop doing this hyperventilating breathing. And I, you know, and just coaching him through it. But I was like, I hadn't thought about like having a side stitch or a cramp from running in so long that I was like, holy shit, I forgot that used to happen a lot. But I can promise you that if you keep doing this, all those little minor inconveniences will eventually go away. I think it's part of it. Your body's like, well, I know this crazy son of a bitch is doing this no matter what. So there's no sense trying to send false flags up because he ain't stopping. And that's the way that's why I handle it. Is, you know, like I said, if you have an injury, you have to stop. I have had small calf tweaks and things where I've stopped in the middle of a run. Like, oh, let me make sure this isn't broken before I keep pushing this because this hurts.
That's amazing advice. And I challenge you to take that for meditation or NSDR because – because that all those cramps happen as well with your mind. And it's the same thing. Ken, where can we send people to connect with you further?
Instagram is like the one that I use the most. Please don't send me a friend request on LinkedIn. If we don't have any business relationship and there's no context to why you want to connect, please don't. It drives me mental when people are like, hey, dude, let's connect on LinkedIn. I'm like, this is a professional like networking website. What's the context? Why would I connect with you? I understand why you might want to connect with me, but why? Because when someone looks at my LinkedIn connections and sees, oh, Ken, you're connected with Danny. Can you introduce me? Yeah, I did his podcast. Let me connect you. But if I don't know you, I'm like, nah, I don't really know him. I just accepted. What's the point? That's like what LinkedIn is for. It's like, you know this person. And if you say, well, how are you going to connect if you don't connect? I don't know. Get creative. But that ain't the way to do it.
Follow this man on Instagram. Linked below. Ken, you're an absolute legend. Thank you so much for spending the time here today and sharing your wisdom.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you.